Okay.
Hi, I want to welcome everyone to our Tuesday night Cashflow Depot conference call. Tonight I'm very excited to have Peter Fortunato and John Schaub as my guest speakers. We haven't had them on the call together in a really long time, so this makes it an extra special conference call. Peter, I know you're already on the line, and I'm not sure if John's here yet, but I'm sure John will be here shortly. Peter, you know, with the Trump election, a lot of people are concerned about what's going to be going on with the real estate business in the future and what kind of changes are going to happen and, you know, what their long-term strategies or short-term strategies should be. Do you see that people should make any kind of changes based on the election?
Well, I'm not much of a fan of Republicans or Democrats, and so I have no faith in any of them. I do feel as though we may have fewer regulations, but that doesn't mean no regulations, and only no regulations are truly honorable and good. So we're going to be faced with other people interfering in our lives, and certainly in the United States now, since we no longer have a capitalist system, we have to stay outside of the system and deal with people where you and I, as capitalists and free people, can make a deal that please us. So from my perspective, no matter what's going on in the macro economy, no matter what Wall Street Journal or the writers talking about politics say, the transactions I do are pretty much done nose to nose with people, not over computers or fax machines, or if anybody still has one of those, but literally face-to-face. And one of the giant weaknesses that I see when I hear people trying to get started in real estate investing is that they're trying to do business with people with a computer screen between them and those people. And so as a result, if you asked me if I would do something, if you made me an offer, and I said no, that no coming across a computer screen, an email, or a text is very, very different than the no when you're sitting across from me and you see that there's tears in my eyes, or that I'm laughing, or that I'm angry. And failure to get face-to-face weakens everybody. They fall into the trap of looking like everyone else, not being known, and recognizing that if you got a goal to reach, and my goal, of course, was when I got out of high school, I had to get myself enough assets so I could be financially free, so I could be comfortably unemployed. Well, getting those assets was hard. And one of the reasons it was hard is because I didn't have enough allies. I had to learn to go out and recruit allies. A friend of mine, Larry Harbold, who was down here in Florida, came down and he heard me speak at a local RIA. And after I spoke at the RIA, he came up to me and he said, you know, what I got from your talk is I don't have enough friends. And that every example I give, every class I teach, every speech I give, I talk about doing business with friends. And I'm always disappointed and surprised when I ask people who they've asked for help, when I ask people, when was the last time you talked to someone who you bought a house from, or you sold a house to, or you rented a house to? And they always say, well, never talk to them again. And that is nuts. When you go out and you try to do some business, you're all by yourself at first. And no one yet knows what you bring to the table. You've got to go out and tell people and ask them for help. So when I went out as a kid and say, listen, I'm going to buy enough real estate so I can be financially free, comfortably unemployed, first of all, it horrified the guidance counselor, and she was no help. But when I went out and started to talk to the realtors and the board, now remember, this is 1965 and 1966, and asked them for help, they did help. And they told me about their experiences. Those experiences, though not my experiences, did become stories that I learned and I learned from, and that I was able to refer to when somebody asked me for help. I'd say, well, I've not done that, but I had a friend who, and all of you have heard me say hundreds and hundreds of times, Warren Harding told us that all opportunity is born of uncomfortable circumstances. The reason you make a friend is when you help people escape uncomfortable circumstances, help them become more comfortable, happier, help them get something they felt they lacked, or get rid of something that they felt was troublesome, burdensome. By doing that, you've made a friend. To then no longer talk to them is just silly. So when you start, you need to recruit allies. If you wait until you bump into just the right person, you may eventually, and you certainly will eventually, bump into someone where you'll make a friend, they'll get to trust you, and they'll make a deal with you. But you should ask for help and help everybody if you want to be a capitalist and go knock on doors, talk to people everywhere you meet them, and bring them aboard to help you, to refer things to you. Now, when you do that, you should stay in touch with every buyer of real estate, every seller of real estate, every renter, every one of them. One of the big surprises that I get, when I teach an acquisition class, the acquisition class is where I preach a lot about capitalism. One of the examples, the biggest example with all the strange and crazy deals that I've done and how very much I love doing those deals, the deal that I did that no one believes is my fourth property. I bought with $10,000 down, $10,000 cash, that I borrowed from my tenant in my second property. And absolutely no one I talk to believes, number one, that a tenant ever had $10,000, and number two, that you could have a good enough rapport as a landlord to borrow from the tenant. Now, because I've told you that I am always recruiting allies, I'm talking to my tenants. They're important to me. That tenant had money in the bank being paid vastly less than the bank would charge me if I borrowed. So my tenant had less income, and they would have charged me more. So by borrowing the money from the tenant, I gave more income to a tenant, which enabled them to better pay me. And I got another property. And she then referred tenants to me. Those relationships enable you at the face-to-face level to make deal after deal. Many people have heard me say, every deal is a seed. And you have to internalize that. Transactions I do, looking back over my 51 years, every one of those transactions pales in its value in comparison to the value of the repeat business and the referral business I did with those people I acquired the property from. Pales by it, because each transaction results in more business and referral business. Now, remember, people make good deals with people they like. Now, John and I are going to talk in the class that's coming up about the starters that go from being starters. This is assuming they even recognize that it's possible. They go from being starters, acquiring some assets, to estate building, building a portfolio, and ultimately to what I always called enders, but Valerie Schaub corrected me and said, no, I don't consider myself an ender. I consider myself a spender. But what I'm talking about is the end of your need to build a bigger portfolio, not like the end, like we're going to call it quits and just lay down and die. I'm talking, and so her calling it spenders is something that John and I have promised to do through the class as opposed to enders any longer. But in any case, at some point, you've got your portfolio. Say again?
So it keeps me out of a lot of trouble if we say that right.
Exactly.
Exactly. John, thanks for joining us on the call.
I've been on been quiet because Pete's doing a great job.
Well, look, people make good deals with people they like. It's hard to get liked typing texts to people. get face-to-face, ask for help, and then offer help.
Now, I had a different experience. He's borrowed from his tenants. I've always borrowed from my landlords. And I've had two landlords that I've rented office space from over the years who have been, I've only had five investors, but these two fellows have been two of my heaviest investors, because every month I'm writing them a check, and they like that, and they know who I am, and they know I know what I'm doing, because they see our business. So, you know, anytime you have a business relationship with somebody, as Pete points out, you should nurture that, because only good things can happen.
Yeah. And when I borrowed from my landlords were my mom and dad. That was how I funded my very first deal, is my mom and dad made me a killer deal, because I was a very skilled negotiator at the age of 19. And they lent me the money it took to buy a house with no note, no interest, no payments, no due date, and no collateral. So negotiating with landlords can be very, very useful.
Yeah, it can be. John, I'm not sure how much you heard about the very first of the call, but I've been getting a lot of calls and emails and comments on the Cashflow Depot website of people that are a little bit concerned about the future of real estate and, you know, what's going to happen with capital gains. Is 1031 exchange going to go away? You know, are the rules and regulations going to get tighter, or is it going to get loosened up? And, you know, I tell people that it doesn't really matter what's going to happen. You just need to get out there and be a deal maker. But what advice would you give people about a future that you're not really certain about what's going to happen? We never know what's going to happen in the future.
I mean, no, but, you know, it seems to me that things may be changing a little faster than they have in the past. You know, it's sort of like when you're driving a car really fast, you've got to look further down the road than you do if you're only driving 10 or 20 miles an hour. And everything's moving pretty fast now. You know, and it's just not real estate, but it's the whole world with all the communication we have, all the technology we have today. That just people are making decisions faster, and the kids just have a different outlook than the folks our age do, I think. But it doesn't mean they're not going to move into houses. All three of my kids have married here the last couple of years, and all three of them two of them are in houses. The third one's about to be in a house. So, you know, they're interested in owning things. So I'm not too concerned about the next generation not buying real estate. And it depends on where you live. But if you're in a growing town, I think in spite of what the federal government will do, your market's still going to be good. But, you know, there's a lot of wild cards out there. The trade deficit, or not trade deficit, but just the whole idea of, are we going to have free trade with other countries or not? So it's just hard to tell what's going to happen. I'm optimistic. I will say that I've got a little bit of money sitting on the side right now, just in case we have some excitement, because I make most of my money when there's some excitement. You know, I make most of my money when people are really uncertain about what's going to happen. That's when you make your best deals. So, you know, like you say, there's going to be opportunities regardless of what happens. But it's a good time, and Peter and I did a class on selling last year. If you're ever going to sell anything, this is not a bad year to consider selling, just because you can. There are years where there's no financing available and nobody's buying, but this year people are buying, and people are starting to pay some pretty silly prices around here. I don't know about the rest of the world, but around the west coast of Florida, people are paying pretty high prices for real estate now. And I don't think we're at the top, but, you know, we're certainly a lot closer to the top than we are at the bottom.
Yep. Well, my vision of value here is coming close to 50% of what houses are actually retailing for. So I'm really having difficulty struggling with the new prices that are happening in my county. I mean, literally, yeah. I'm looking at houses and say, oh, yeah, I bet that's $85,000. And they say, well, we're asking $180,000 and it only needs $50,000 in work. So
yeah.
I've been sort of left behind in terms of the pricing.
Just last weekend in Dallas, Texas, I had a vacancy in one of my rental properties, which is very, very rare. And I took the opportunity to do some maintenance that needed to be done on the property to get it in tip-top shape before I put it back on the market. And then I got someone to do an open house for me on Saturday for a couple hours and Sunday for a couple hours, and ran some ads on the internet, put some signs up. This is for a rental property. I was absolutely blown away because, you know, I knew what the rents were, but I hadn't really kept up with what the value was. Just 2 years ago, this was a $135,000 house. It's now worth $175,000.
Mm-hmm.
in just 2 years. But even more surprising was the 300 people that came to see the house and that made phone calls about the property. And I would say half of them said that they were looking for another place to move into because the house they'd been renting for the last 4 or 5 or 6 years, the landlord was selling it out from underneath them, and they had to go find a new place to live. And it's because, you know, the prices are so high right now in Dallas that a lot of landlords are taking advantage of it and doing some exchanging or selling their assets, but that's causing a big transition for renters.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to get back to where I was talking about just getting started.
Okay.
A person today to get started and to talk to some of us older people, they're going to see the horror in our eyes at prices. But people make good deals with people they like. Again, I'm saying you have to get face-to-face with people. People do business with people they like. That means you got to establish a rapport. That means you got to find out what's going on in their lives. You have to smile occasionally. You have to be concerned and caring. Then they do business with people, assuming they like them, they'd like to know and be assured of their trustworthiness and their competence. Now, when you're getting started, that's hard. You know, when I was 18 years old and I looked like I was 14, and my goal was to get enough houses so that I could do nothing I didn't want to do for the rest of my life, I went out and I made 200 offers before the first one closed. I had my dream, I had my goals, I had my plan, and then it was time for me to get started. And I got started and I wrote offer after offer after offer. I think I was likable enough. But the issue was people looked at me and saw a kid that was unemployed or a realtor, depending upon who was describing what occupation I had. And they just didn't have faith in my competence. I was fortunate enough to live in a town where my family was well-known. So I think the trustworthy part was easier for me than it might be for somebody starting raw in a new town. But the competence is hard to sell when you're just getting started and you have none of your own example. So it took me 200 offers to get my first property, more than 200 actually. And I was at John's class a couple of years ago and somebody said to him, you know, how long did you and Pete study before you were ready to do your first deal? And John's answer was such a great one. He said, what Pete and I had in common is we were brave. And I think that's a very necessary component because you've got to get started. And if you don't ever offer, if you just sit, if you read, if you wish, nothing happens. You've got to get started. You've got to jump in. And I got started more than 200 times before I finally got a house.
Well, you know, when you're first starting, you really don't have much to lose if you've got your head on straight. If your net worth is under $20,000 and you're just starting in this business, all you can lose is $20. Now, that's a lot of money to you, but in the big picture, that's not much money. So you should gamble that. You should should invest that money. And when I say gamble, I mean I don't think any of us are gamblers. We take risks that we understand, but we're pretty sure that when we buy something, that we'll be able to hold on to it long enough to make a profit. And that's the whole game in my plan is to hold on to something long enough so you look smart. You know, sometimes it takes a few years to look smart, but if you hang on and you own the same property and you bought a good property to start with, one day you'll look smarter. And, you know, the stuff we bought when we were starting is now worth 10 times what we paid for it. So it makes you feel pretty good when you see numbers like that.
Yeah. Well, I just mentioned getting started and all those offers before I got one. And when I was 35 years old, so after 17 years, I had 33. So just to kind of give you an idea, once I got rolling, I was able to acquire enough product, but I wasn't doing the stories you hear about hundreds and thousands of deals. It became easier and easier. People ask me now, where do you find your deals? Almost everything that comes to me, you know, I'm always scolding them and saying, you don't find a deal, you find an opportunity. But indeed, the opportunities come to me because my phone rang. Because for 50 years, I made friends. I recruited allies. I helped people make deals. Now, I had a closing this afternoon. The seller has been my friend for 30 years. We have done dozens of deals together. So when you get to that point, once you're getting older, and if you're paying attention to the people you bought from and sold from and going back to them, how hard was it for me to establish a rapport with somebody who's been a friend of mine for 30 years and with whom I've done dozens of deals? Did they believe that I'm competent and trustworthy? See, all of those were a given, making the deal a million times easier. And the closing agent that I closed with this afternoon has been doing 80%+ of my closings for the last 20-plus years. Well, that makes it easier and easier. And as you go from being a starter to being an estate builder and you develop those friends around you and you begin to use them to help you make deals, and every deal is beneficial for them, so they're enthused for you, it becomes easier and easier. Now, the deal I did today, I exchanged a promise for a deed. That's a very common currency for me. I had a lady who wanted to have income and, believe it or not, was tired of dealing with tenants. Despite my suggesting that she go take David Tilney's management class, she hasn't. She's done a nice job of having some real estate over the years, and she just doesn't want any more tenants. She's done. She wants to keep her income, but she doesn't want any more management. So I bought a property from her and gave her a promise, a note, promising her $500 every month for the next 15 years. So that transaction happened today. It was done finally because the closer really would prefer we put something down on a piece of paper. We wrote down what we were doing. But it was done as a relationship deal between friends. Now, we made that deal today. We made a deal. The $500 a month payment was arrived at because $900 a month is all this house is renting for. It is absolutely my intention that if I keep this house, I will get that rent up. But when I was a kid, I would have acquired this house as a starter. That's a killer deal. I had very little money out of pocket. Closing costs were mine. And I acquired a house with a promise, a purchase money note, first mortgage on the property. Would have been a keeper property for me. It's about 20 miles from my house, so it's further away than I like now that I'm older. And so my goal in doing this was not just to acquire a good house that a tenant could afford to pay for me, but it was to acquire a house with the understanding by everybody at that closing that I'm going to trade that house for a house down closer to me down here in Pinellas County. And when I do, I'm going to move the mortgage off of that property up in Pasco County and move it onto a property closer to home. Closer to home is better for me and better for her. Now, that happens much more easily today than it would have when I was a kid. And when I was a kid, I wouldn't have even been thinking about that deal beyond the deal where I brought it closer to home. I would simply have been thinking, wow, I got a house the tenant can pay for. If I just live long enough, the 15 years will be gone, and I'll look smart, just like John said. Property will have been paid for by the tenant. From her perspective, she sold the house to someone she's known for 30 years and done business with for years. If she cashed that property out and put the money in the bank, a bank would give her, if she could cash it out and put the money in the bank, the money in the bank would earn 0.5%. So I was offering her 5%. So that's only 10 times as much. But when you key that in and don't think about it as 10 times as much, but instead you say, if she wants $500 a month and she puts the money in the bank, if she could turn the house into money and put it in the bank, that money is going to last 10 years. At 15%, I'm sorry, at 5%, it's going to last 15 years. Well, who wouldn't rather have 15 years of income than 10? Those are not hard things to sell, but you have to be able to sit down and talk with people about those kinds of deals. So today's deal was to buy a property the tenant could afford, give a seller an income stream, promise a seller an income stream that's longer than she could have otherwise, promise her freedom from management. And the deal beyond the deal is that tomorrow I will either move the security because I traded for a house closer to home, or I'll sell the house. And if I sell the house up there and move the collateral, I'll have borrowed cash at 5% for 15 years. And I can put that to work, either paying something else off or buying something else. And so that's what happens as you mature and deals do become easier and you structure the transaction. So that was an example of a deal that I would have done as a kid, but I did with a different intent today. But if I do nothing but keep that property, someday my kids or my grandkids would be glad they're related to me, and that's important to me. That's why I've been very surprised to see how very much leveraging I've been doing. At age 69, I didn't have a vision of myself as being leveraging like crazy, but with rates where they are and the ability to buy houses with purchase money financing, I've been going crazy the last couple of years. And crazy, again, is not buying hundreds of houses, but buying nice properties in nice neighborhoods that I'm very happy to acquire for my family.
Yeah, I just want to remind everybody, if you have a question for Peter or John, all you need to do is press *6, and I'll be glad to unmute your line. I'm not taking any email questions tonight. If you have a question, you have to press *6 to ask your question. Mm-hmm. John, I have a question for you. The deal that Peter just described is a perfect example of when you're going into a deal, you've got to start thinking about, what's your plan for that property? What's your exit strategy? Are you going to sell it? Are you going to keep it? Are you going to exchange it? You know, what are you going to do? And without knowing what your exit strategy is, it's hard to know the best way to structure the offer when you're going to buy it. So can you give a little bit of commentary on how people need to think about in their different stages of real estate investing, what their exit strategy might be and how that could change their entrance strategy?
Well, it's interesting. Many houses I bought, I thought I had an exit strategy, and then I still have them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, your exit strategy might be you're going to keep it as a rental property. Your exit strategy mm-hmm. might be that you're going to, like the one that Peter just talked about, that you're going to buy it today, but your ultimate goal might be to exchange it next month for something closer to home.
Well, what we've learned is, you know, the whole thing revolves around your position of strength as a negotiator. And if you buy something that you don't mind holding for a long period of time, regardless of what the economy does, then you're in a very strong position to negotiate if somebody wants to buy the house from you, or if you want to exchange it for something else, or whatever deal you want to make. However, if you buy something that you don't like, and I've done that a few times, I've ended up in hotels, apartment buildings, and a car wash in Lakeland, and then, you know, some properties I didn't like, well, that puts you in a weak negotiating position. So step one here in having a good exit strategy is having a good entrance strategy, you know, by buying mm-hmm. something that you're not worried about holding on to and that you're happy to hold on to. But to piggyback on what Pete was talking about, we taught a class in January, and we found two things. Number one, we found investors, just like the fellow or the lady that Pete just bought from, who are done managing. You know, they've owned properties for 10 or 15 years, and these are houses they may have paid 50 for. Now they're worth 150 or 200, and they'd rather have something other than a tenant right now because they're getting up in years, and they want more freedom. Well, if you're getting started, that's exactly who you should be looking for. You can make deals, and some of the best deals I made early on are with people who already own property, and I would agree to manage their property for half the profits we made from this point forward, and I would create a cash flow spread for myself, you know, not a commission, but part of the profit. And the difference between taking a commission and part of the profit is part of the profit increases every year if you're a good manager. As you increase your rents, your cash flow gets better. You know, when you create cash flow spreads that have increasing cash flow, you've done a lot of things right. You know, we used to sell property and carry back notes and carry back wraparounds and all those things, you know, produce cash flow, but they don't normally produce increasing cash flow. So you look back at some of those 5, 15 years ago, and the cash flow was same as it was then, but the hamburger costs more today. So to have increasing cash flow is a wonderful thing. And so we'll spend some time talking about structuring deals with increasing cash flow in the class, because I think, you know, if you're going to be around for another 10 or 20 or 30 years, and hopefully everybody will be, you want your cash flow to increase. You don't want it to be stationary. You don't want it to be stable.
Yeah. And by the way, I didn't even mention it yet, but John and Peter are going to be teaching a class on May 20th and 21st in Tampa, Florida. You can get more information by going to either one of their websites. Peter's website is www.peterfortunato.com, or you can go to John Schaub, www.johnschaub.com, and there's information about your class. What's the title of this class?
It's evolving.
It's going to be a darn good class because Peter and John are teaching it, so you can be absolutely sure it's going to be an amazing class. You know,
We do have a great time together.
But, yeah, anybody that has as much experience as John and Peter have, these are the kind of people you need to be listening to. You know, so many people are going to seminars with somebody that's 27 years old and he's done, you know, 14 deals, and they think, woohoo. But, you know, think about someone that's been in the business, you know, 30, 40, 50.
100 years, right, 100 years.
Yeah, yep. 100 years combined. You know, this is, and they've seen the ups and downs of the economy. They've seen all kinds of changes with different political parties, and they've weathered the storm through it all. And that's the kind of people you need to be learning from. We got a few questions
Before you get away from exit strategies, when I began, my exit strategy was to die and have my family get a stepped-up basis. I bought the property with every intention. That didn't mean die like at 18. That meant die at 100 years old or 120 years old and have the family get a stepped-up basis.
And I just made my first offer.
Go ahead, Peter.
No, that's fine. I love to hear about her first offer. I'm just letting you know, keeping a property forever is also a very fine way to do property. And the properties that I got, some of them I have traded up for something I thought was better, but the investment in property has remained since I was in my early 20s. The property is now property 1E as opposed to 1, because 1 traded into 1A, then 1B, and so now I'm on what I think is a better property. That said, I traded one house in Massachusetts on the North Shore of Boston for seven houses in Florida in 1986. And today that one house in Boston is more valuable than all seven.
Yeah, let me go ahead and take this call.
All right,
Okay.
The first deal.
Yes, hi.
Go ahead, area code 516. Go ahead.
Yes, okay, hi. Sorry, they said that I could ask a question. I didn't mean to interrupt anybody. I'm very new at this, and I found a for sale by owner, and it was zoned E. That means that in the area it could be for commercial or residential, and right now it's a two-family residential, and he was asking $329. So I just called, and this is the first time I did it. I said, you know what, let me just see if he'll do owner financing. I've just been reading about it. I'm not that keen on everything, but I asked if he was willing to possibly do some owner financing. He had said yes. He called me. He's actually living down in Florida right now. He's just retired with his wife. They're in their early 60s. And he had said that he would possibly be willing to do it. So he called me, and we were on the phone for about 45 minutes. And just, I don't know if it was Peter or John that was saying it's important to make have relationships. So I really developed a very nice relationship with him within the 45 minutes, and we had some personal questions and things like that. But just to make a long story short, to the offer, he was asking $329. So when I worked up the numbers, I figured I could possibly, my offer was to offer him $300,000 with $300,000 for the purchase price, with $50,000 a down payment, which I have, but I do hear from some people you try not to use your own money. And the mortgage would be at $250 at that point. And then when I worked out the numbers with the taxes, insurance, vacancy, repairs, that percentage, what it came out to was basically the way I would do it, I would pay him, I wanted to pay him a flat fee. I didn't want to do any interest rate at all. So he would have got $1,000 a month, and I would have made $900 a month in positive cash flow from the rental, because there are two rentals. So I had brought that information to him, and then I was listening to him. We were talking again, and he wanted to tell me what his bottom line was. So he wanted to sell the house for $310. He didn't want to go any lower than $310, and he was looking for a 10-year payment at 5% with a 5-year balloon. So then when I worked out those numbers, it wasn't anything. Yes, very good, Chuck. But this is good. This is a very good experience for me. This is literally my first deal. I was very happy that I had the cojones to just go and speak to him and actually speak first and try to do something. But with that monthly payment came out for me would be $27.57.70. So that actually, when I worked out all the numbers again monthly, that put me in the negative cash flow of $273. Hence, my first deal that I'm thinking, you know, is no good. So I spoke to him today, and I told him, you know, that just won't work for me. And again, I feel like we developed a really great relationship. It's been through text and phone calls, and I'm a big believer in face-to-face as well. And he said, well, what about maybe if we could try a 15-year payment, which unfortunately at 5% it still puts me in a negative. It really doesn't work out for me. So then I was thinking in my own head before I spoke to him, let me do what other option can I maybe put forth to him? And I was thinking master lease. And then just what I read Jackie's manual about the highest bidder sale. So then I presented that to him as well, that if for some reason we couldn't come to any terms or agreements on the house, that maybe I could do a highest bidder sale for him if he's having trouble. He's in Florida. I could take care of everything here and so forth. So for my first shot, any help, any advice?
Where is here?
New York. I'm sorry. On Long Island.
Oh. Okay. Okay. And he's in Florida.
Yes, he's there. He's there now full time.
Okay. All right. He doesn't seem
too motivated. Like I'm sorry. He always I read a lot of things in webinars, and they always say you want to look for those motivated sellers, motivated sellers. I believe to some degree he is motivated because he doesn't want to be a landlord. And his sister was here, and she actually showed me the place. So
she's motivated.
Yeah, I think he's. I'm sure there's some motivation in him as well. But so, is there any suggestions?
What does the property rent for?
He gets it's a total of $3,500. A month. He gets these as a two bedroom downstairs, $2,150 and $1,354, a one bedroom upstairs.
Okay. And what kind of operating expenses might you have? Will it cut the income in half? Taxes,
well,
insurance, maintenance, supplies, cleaning, advertising, vacancy?
Right. So I always want to put in everything that I do and everything, again, that I've read is that you always want to put in for the vacancy rate. And you always want to put in for repairs just in case to have that. So when I put in, I put the vacancy rate at 7%, repairs were about at 7%. So that's always in the monthly, that's in my monthly payment that I want to always make sure I have. Is that correct, or I shouldn't account for so much?
Well, you need to look at it. So, because some houses really are in great condition. Other houses need a ton of work just to get started. So if he's been... When you hear people say, I have very few expenses, number one, they could be lying to both you and themselves. Number two, they're not lying, and that's worse because that means the property hasn't been repaired in ages. And so you've got to catch up to even get started, but you need to know that. if I were looking at that property without knowing the first thing about New York, I would have taken the income and cut it in half to figure that was, assuming the house was in good condition, that was all the money I was going to have. Certainly, if I was even considering putting $50,000 down, I would then want a return on my $50,000. Now, that return, and when I was getting started, would have had to have been some sort of a cash flow return. Maybe not a ton of it, but it had to be something. As I got older and had more properties, I might accept a return in the form of amortization as the loan was paid down. But in the case you're talking about, if you said to him, I'll do the 15 years, but I'll do the 5% interest, but I'll do it at interest only for 15 years, that might make the thing work for you if you really want to buy a duplex.
Well, one of the things I would suggest is put the details of the deal on the Cash Flow Depot community forum, and we can offer a lot of advice on how to put that deal together. But I don't want to spend too much time on that one deal because we only have John and Peter on the call for about an hour. But put the details on Cash Flow Depot, and then we'll be able to offer you a lot of other examples of different things that you can do and alternative offers that you could make.
Well, let me just say your first offer was a good offer because you calculated that you were going to make about $800 or $900 a month and pay him $1,000 a month.
Yep.
And those numbers make sense to me because that's about, if you take the $3,500 and divide it by half, $1,750, and have $1,000 a month, you're making $750. So that's good. Your thought process was good. He didn't go away. That's good. You know, he came back to you with a different offer. My advice to you is let him cool off a little bit. Go back to him maybe in 2 weeks and ask him if he still has a property and see if he has had any other thoughts. Because at some point, he may make somebody a good deal on this property. Is this your home market? You know this property really well?
She's not on the call anymore, John.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Well, just make sure you know values well. I mean, and the other thing I do, I look him up, see what he paid for it, and because if he paid 50 for it, you know, 20 years ago, then he's going to be a lot easier to deal with than somebody that bought it for 250 3 years ago. I'm always looking for somebody who's owned a property for a long period of time that has a whole bunch of profit in it, because I know when I'm in that position, I'm easier to deal with. So I assume everybody else is easier to deal with, too.
Yeah, exactly.
I have
a question. Next caller, area code 727.
Yeah, I have a question for John. You just said it. Do you still have the property in Lake Sarasota, the five or six houses we did together in 1980?
Who is it?
Alan.
It's Alan. Yeah, I do. I think I've sold off a couple of them. I've got the rest of them. Those are very well-built houses, by the way. And my nation is there's one guy who's been with me now for almost 20 years. He wants to replace the carpet. And I said, well, you just moved in 20 years ago. Why do you want to replace the carpet already?
Just don't have them call me. Now, I was a developer in Sarasota. And I knew both John and Pete from the Warren Harding days. And the interest rates were at 17%. I sold the subdivision to U.S. Homes, and I had five or six houses left. So John did what he mentioned earlier. He said, well, put them together. I'll manage them. And when you want to get out, you get out, which we did over a period of time. But I never liked the thrill of management. These were brand-new houses. And they were nice ones in a nice area, so it was a win-win situation. But I just want to tell you all on the call, these two guys, this is not a paid advertisement. These are phenomenal people, and like I say, we've known each other for over 40 years. We did some deals back then. I've been in the woodwork, and I've been talking with Pete about doing some other deals coming out of the woodwork.
Well, thank you, Alan.
Yep.
Thanks, Alan. Yeah, yep. Pete and John are the real deal for sure.
Yeah, okay, the one thing before you go away from that for the lady just for 1 second. The lady has an owner who has a property in New York, and he lives in Florida. So what I would do is a very simple thing to do is to go to whatever county he's in Florida, and look for all the tax bills that are sent to the zip code where the New York property is. That means there are people in New York who own property in Florida. Then I would make them an offer, let them carry the paper in New York close to them and see if I could trade the guy a house closer to where he lives. And for many people, they're a lot more secure having property nearby. It's a very easy list for you to get because the tax collector in every town has all the addresses of everyone that owns property in that town or in that county.
Yeah, great idea. There's so many different ways to skin a cat.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also a story behind the story, too. I remember a house I bought not long ago, and we got the seller to finance it at 4% interest, and came to find out that she had borrowed money from her sister at no interest at all. So she was making her spread 4% to zero interest, but the sister was happy because she started getting payments now. And so, you know, it's great. You find out more about people when you make that first offer. That's why this lady who's been on the phone with us, she did the right thing. She made the offer, and she got some feedback from this fella. And there's a really good chance she can put that deal together if she wants that property, because and maybe she can get a little bit lower down payment, a little bit lower monthly payments, but she can make a deal with that guy probably.
Yeah, you know, he wants to sell, she wants to buy. They just have to figure out where the common ground is. And he's long distance, so that
definitely
makes it motivated.
But at least they got the communication. She spent quite a bit of time talking to him. Without the communication, it's hard. You know, you fire off a contract and you hope something happens. But, boy, it's tough without communication.
You're exactly right. Yeah, we've got another question from area code 407. Go right ahead.
Yes, good evening, Jackie and Pete and John. I just wanted to ask if they think that chasing REOs is still a good strategy in this market.
Chasing would not be a word I'd like.
Yeah, I mean, there's opportunity there for sure. We have one deal that's supposed to close next week that we bought for probably 60 cents on the dollar. There's another one yesterday that's going into foreclosure, so we're going to try to buy it before it becomes an REO. But there's still a lot of foreclosures. I mean, there's still a lot of banks that have bad paper. There's a whole second level of paper, all the countrywide stuff that's still out there. They had a whole second mortgages, you know, billions of dollars worth. And they're all going to foreclosure now because they've been waiting for the equity to build up. So they're going to foreclose on a lot of those houses. So I'd say sure, you know, but make sure it's a property that you want to own. Don't chase foreclosures just because they're foreclosures. Make sure they're good properties, good areas that you want to own.
And when you submit an offer, follow up on it. The couple of things, I don't do very much of that kind of stuff at all because I tend to want to sit down with people I like and do business with people I like, and banks are not included in those people I like. But the people I know who are successful with it, by and large, make a lot of offers. And then they have either a helper or they themselves follow up every month or every 90 days and say, you know, what became of our offer? And every once in a while they say, oh, are you still interested in that property? Because there's no one there who has their money on the line, so they don't stay attentive. And I was talking to a friend here recently, and he said a couple of times every year they end up buying a house that they'd made offers on months and months and months ago. And just when they call, the people said, oh, you're still interested in buying that house? Yeah, we do that. And so do follow up. When they ignore you, that doesn't mean you should ignore them.
Yeah, the offer we're closing on, you know, we made the offer and somebody else outbid us, but then the person who outbid us couldn't get financing, so they came back to us and said, well, we'll take a cheaper price because we're ready to go. Another story, though, it's kind of the opposite of what Pete's been talking about. A lot of the brokers or agents that have these properties listed are total nincompoops. We had one deal where we had an appointment to see the property. It didn't show up. They never called us back. We called them back. They said, well, we lost your number. I said, really? You didn't show up at the showing and you lost our number? That's my kind of realtor. So we followed up and made an offer to them because we figured that they were never going to sell it to anybody else, and we were able to buy it for about 50 cents on the dollar. So there's just because of the nature of the business, and there are so many amateurs in the business, both people who have licenses and other folks who are landlords and other people who have loaned people money and can't collect, there's always an opportunity out there. So if you go out and talk to people, you're going to find these opportunities.
Yeah. And to that point, if you're writing an offer to anybody, especially through a realtor, make sure you put your name and then your phone number on that contract, because you'd like them to be able to find it as opposed to lose the deal. And I put it there. Every once in a while, a broker will say, well, why'd you put your phone number on there? And I don't want to say it's because I don't have any faith in you. I want the people to really get back to me. But whatever the reason, it doesn't hurt. It's no big deal to add your phone number to the contract. Right at the front, at the top where it says, I'm the buyer. This is my name, and here's my phone number. That's important. I put the seller's phone number on there so I'll remember and be able to get in touch with them. But I think that's important, because you do hear that where things just fall by the wayside and no one gets back.
Yeah, I tend to buy things the first day they're listed, or the last day, you know, after the listing is about to expire from realtors. The first day, sometimes they've listed something way below the market, and their fear is somebody else is going to sell it, so I'll get the call because they know I'll buy it right away. And then the last day of the listing, you know, they're afraid their listing is going to expire, they're not going to get paid, so they'll accept almost any offer that day to try to make it work. So you work both ends of that time period to make those deals.
Now, Peter and John, we don't have about 10 minutes left. Can you give me a little bit more information about the seminar that you're teaching in May?
Well, couple titles. One is called Strategies and Tactics from Starting to Spending. So that's what Peter's been talking about. We're going to cover the whole spectrum, I think, from people getting started to people who are getting to the point where they don't need to buy anymore. They need to manage what they have and maybe convert some of it to more cash flow. And then the other subtitle is Preparing for the Future, Investing in a Brave New World. And we're going to talk about some of the and that's why we're a little vague on the content at this point. You know, things are changing. And I think between now and April, we'll know a lot more about maybe the economy and the direction everything is going in, and then we'll be able to talk more about the changes in regulations and changes in tax laws and changes in a lot of things that will affect people like us who are full-time investors.
Mm-hmm. Pete, did you have something to add to that?
I think it's important that you realize when we're talking about full-time investing, because that's what we've done for a very, very long time. But we've got to be able to stay attentive to the people that we do business with who primarily are not full-time investing. I just made an offer to do an exchange of an investment property that I've had for a very, very, very long time. My basis is $20,000, and I offered to trade it to a young man who had a beautiful house in a much nicer neighborhood, in my view. So I offered to trade my waterfront rental house for a nice house here in Seminole near the schools and the things that I really like. Well, for him, it's a code section 121, meaning it's his personal residence where he's owned it and lived in it for two out of the last 5 years. For me, it's 1031. So being familiar with those things, I know how I would structure it for me. I can help him if he chooses. But I got to recognize his situation is totally different than mine. And so I will make available to him publication 523 so he can look it up. He can take it to his accountant and see that he can be tax-free in that transaction. So the things that we learn are not just for use by ourselves. They're things that we use to help others. And by helping others, we're able to earn a position for ourselves in the deal. Because you do business, you know, you make friends, you establish rapport, because you help people. And we were just talking at the Roth IRA class. When I took my first class from Chuck Considine on taxation and tax avoidance and 1031 and structuring and using entities, I was earning $8,000 a year. And he started the class by saying, now, everyone here has at least $1.2 million in net worth, because otherwise, there'd be no reason for you to be wasting your time learning this stuff. Well, I was learning it, and I was a little shy of the $1.2 million net worth he was talking about when I was making $8,000 a year, and I was borrowing my dad's car to show the real estate. But by learning what I learned from him, I was able to help other people save those taxes, which enormously benefited me and enabled me to earn my way into transactions. So you're always learning, if not for your specific situation, so that you can help other people and make a deal.
Yeah, and when you can talk to the seller about like a 1031 exchange and they had no idea that they could sell their personal residence and not have to pay capital gains on it, that gives you instant credibility with the seller. So they're much more likely to accept some kind of an offer other than a traditional offer of you've got to go to the bank and get financing and cash them out. Because then what are they going to do with all that money? Just sit it in the bank, like you said, at earning less than 0.5% interest rate. So when you educate them about earning 4% or 5% interest versus the money sitting in the bank, that also gives you instant credibility.
Mm-hmm. And often I don't. I mean, because people come to me because I've done this so long, they perceive, perhaps misperceive, that I am somehow expert in it. But what happens is, I end up giving them, when I'm doing installment sales, which is probably, it's probably 85% of the deals that I do are trading a note, creating an installment sale to allow people who want to tax defer without doing a 1031 exchange. I print out a copy of Publication 537, which you can get on any computer today, and tell them, take this to your accountant, and talk to them about it, because it's such a valuable thing. And people who I run into, because of my age and because of where I live, a lot of people that I talk to, a lot of my friends, are at that point in their life where they want more, they want stable income, but they really don't want to take on more property, as I've said before. Publication 537 will show them how to do that and let them go to their accountant to find it out. One of my favorite stories was when I talked to Lou Gooch, who's a close friend who a lot of the guys around Pinellas would have known. And when Lou was 77, I made him an offer to have him finance some properties for me for a long time, to hold the financing. And Lou said, Pete, I'm 77. I don't even buy green bananas. And he didn't want to carry the financing. And I told him, one of my favorite quotes from Jack Miller was, it's inconvenient to be physically alive but financially dead. You want your money to outlive you. And we talked about that, and he carried a 20-year note for me. And on November 1st of 2009, I went to his house and gave him his last payment and told him the reason he was never getting another payment is because he was such a pessimist, he only wrote a 20-year note when he was 77. Those are important stories because people don't think about that. They think, oh, I'm 75, so I've got to get the cash. Well, having the cash run out, we talked to a broker for a lady who was 100 years old and was evicted from the ACLF where she lived because she ran out of money. Carrying financing can enable people to not be in that situation.
Yeah, very good point. You know, with my tour business in Panama, I have a relocation tour business, and I have a lot of people that are retirees from all over the world that come on my tour, and the common denominator with many of them is that they just can't afford to stay in the country that they've lived in all of their life, that in retirement they just don't, their Social Security or pension or savings or lack of savings and absolutely no assets at all has made it necessary that they need to find a place where it's more affordable to live. And people just had one rental property that was paid for. It could make all the difference in the world in their life. So, you know, we talk about being a full-time real estate investor and spending every waking hour looking for opportunities and talking to sellers. And that's great for people that's the path that they want to take. But you can also take the path that you set aside on, I'm just going to buy one house a year or one extra rental house in my lifetime or two extra rental houses in my lifetime, just so that I have a more secure retirement. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. It doesn't have to be you're going to be a full-time real estate investor. You just can't do this business. You can also just look at this as a way to improve your position when you do get ready to retire, whether that's at 37 years old or 67 years old. The real estate will produce the cash flow to give you the financial freedom that we're all looking for, and choices whenever you do retire, that you've got the choice to stay right where you are if you want to and not having to be forced to move to someplace else, or maybe you really don't want to move away from friends and family and grandchildren, but you have no other choice because you just can't afford it. So look at real estate as a way to create incredible wealth and a lot of cash and a lot of cash flow, and you can do it full time, but you can also just do one deal a year, and it will make such a difference in your life.
Sure. My book, Building Wealth One House at a Time, Jackie, we talked just about that, you know, and you're probably familiar with that, but that book is in its 15th printing now, and is, you know, sold over 100,000 copies, and people embrace that concept of moving slow and steady, you know. I'm meeting with a young man tomorrow morning who's a medical doctor here in town, and he wants to start buying one house a year, and he wants my guidance on how to do it. But, you know, he makes lots of money, but he understands the program, that you don't have to be in a hurry, and you're much better off not being in a hurry because you don't know what the cycle is going to do. You know, you're better off averaging in and averaging out than you are buying all in 1 year. So
Yeah,
just talk about change for a second, because I know we're getting close to the end here. The people who embrace change and welcome change are the ones that are going to profit from the next couple of years as the economy and the world continues to change. Most people don't like change. You know, they stick their head in the sand and hope it'll go away. But if you can keep open-minded and you know, understand how change can benefit you, if the interest rates change or the tax laws change, all that is good for real estate investors because it confuses most people. Most people just won't make good decisions. And if you've got your head on straight about it, you can make good decisions. And the next few years can be very good for you.
Good point. Peter, any final words of wisdom before we call it a night?
Well, I can't imagine a more enjoyable life than we have by going out and making deals that help our families, help the people we love, and help others. And so if you will just jump in and do something, it does not mean you have to become full-time or a career person. It's a lot of fun to feel yourself and your family getting better off because of things you did. And it can be as simple as having two or three or four. I know so many people with fewer than five houses, and now they're getting older like I am, and those houses are getting free and clear, and they never bought any. One lady in particular never bought a rental house in her life, but she kept every single house she's ever lived in. So she now, in her 60s, has five houses, and four of them are free and clear. It's totally changing to her life to have those four houses when she retires. So it's not. It doesn't need to be a huge deal.
Yeah, and you know, you hear about people doing 100 deals a year. You don't need. You know, you don't. First of all, you're going to be worn out at the year, but you don't have to do. It doesn't have to be that high volume. You can make such a difference in your life with just one deal a year, two deals a year. It doesn't have to be the high volume. Unless that's what you want to do, but you can make such a difference with just a little bit. Well, yeah. Peter and John, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the call tonight. I've really enjoyed all the things that you've talked about, and we've had a couple hundred people on the call, and I'm sure they've enjoyed everything too. I've already gotten some emails on the Cashflow Depot forum saying, when's the replay going to be ready? So people are ready to listen to it. Once again, Peter and John are teaching a seminar in Tampa on May the 20th and the 21st. And you can get information by going to peterfortunato.com or johnschaub.com with more details about the class and registering for it. Thanks again, John. Thanks again, Pete.
All right. Thank you very much.
And good night, everybody. Thanks for being on the call tonight.
Good night.